Does it ever feel like you're a marketing professional just speaking into the void? Well, with LinkedIn ads, you can know you're reaching the right decision makers. You can even target them by job title, industry, company, role, seniority, skills, company revenue, and did I say job title yet? Get started today and see how you can avoid the void and reach the right buyers with LinkedIn ads. To get £100 off your first campaign, go to linkedin.com/lead to claim your credit. Terms and conditions apply.
Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working, offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year, mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
Hey listeners, welcome to Immigrantly. I am Sadia Khan. I know my voice sounds a bit weird today because I have allergies and I'm not feeling great. But you know what? I still wanted to do this episode because I am so excited about my today's guest. And I thought, why not? Now, before we get into today's episode, I just want to give a big shout out to our Apple Podcasts subscribers. Seriously, guys, you hit that subscribe button and now we are forever connected. We are basically besties. It means so much to know you believe in what we're doing here. I see you and I really appreciate you. And hey, if you haven't subscribed yet, for whatever reason, come join the Immigrantly Uninterrupted family. It's just $3.99 a month or $34.99 a year on Apple Podcasts. It helps keep this thing going and I promise it's worth it. And now to today's conversation. Anna Barber is a longtime journalist and host of The Stoop.
And he wrote this book called No Ashes in the Fire, Coming of Age, Black and Free in America.
Like so many black boys who would grow up to love and lust after other boys, I would have died had I not found safety in my imagination.
This podcast digs into the uncomfortable, joyful, and deeply complex layers of black identity. She's Sudanese American, Bay Area based, and one of those people who speaks with equal parts clarity and curiosity. But I did just want to talk to Hannah about journalism. I wanted to talk about memory, sound, and becoming. We get into all of that in this episode. So without further ado, let's get started. I'm so happy we are doing this, despite my weird voice.
Oh, your voice is lovely. Your voice is lovely. Raspy is the new thing.
I've been listening to some of your TED Talks, your podcast episodes, and these days I'm really into sounds. Ironically, my voice is gone, but I am really into sounds and trying to explore soundscape of different places. I grew up in Pakistan. The soundscape is so different there, right? Vendors yelling, kids playing, people talking, rickshaws honking. And the U.S. has a quieter soundscape, especially in the suburbs. When you think of Sudan, what sounds come to mind?
Oh, yes. So for us, family is huge. The sounds that stay with me are always loud conversations and laughter of my family members. We have huge families. And so there are many cousins and aunties and uncles, and everybody ends up every week at the grandmother's house. That's the biggest sound that stays with me and that I really miss, is like the cacophony of many people talking at the same time. And, you know, it feels like nobody's listening to one another, but they are. So that loud kind of conversation that has, there's like slapping in the middle of it, like that. Like, that's what I miss. That's the, which doesn't make sense for somebody in audio, because we always want the clear sound, no background noise. But that's what it is for me. That's what it is for me. And weddings. Our weddings are elaborate, and they're like week long, and the music and the drumming and the singing of little girls and the laughter. The environment of a wedding sonically is, there's nothing like it for us.
You just said that that's contrary to what we look for in audio in the US, right? Do you ever chase that sound in your reporting? Have you ever tried to include it in your work?
Yes. So I've been in radio news and storytelling for 20 years now. And a big part of it is when you go out and you do an interview with somebody, you're looking for the scene to record ambient sound, to record them while they're doing something, to record just like the atmosphere so that you're able to take listeners to this place just through audio. So we want the interview to be in the clear. But then after the interview or before the interview, there is always looking to see what else I can record. If they're in their kitchen, she's making tea and the kettle is whistling. You know, the dog comes in. Just to set a sonic scene. So we're always looking for that, yes.
At Pure Gym, whatever you're here for, we're here for it. So whether you're here to meet your goals or meet your gals, take a bit of me time or a weight off. Getting back on the bike.
Last one, big push.
Or spilling the tea while you spin. They said what? We're here for it. With 50% off your first month and no joining fee for a limited time. Whatever you're here for, we're here for it. Pure Gym. Terms and conditions apply.
The new £5 meal deal from McDonald's. Get a cheeseburger or mayo chicken, medium fries, four McNuggets, and a medium soft drink for guess what? That's right, £5. It's not called the £5 meal deal for nothing. From 11 a.m. Not available on delivery. Carbonated soft drink upgrade fees apply. Participating restaurants subject to availability.
I was listening to one of your TED Talks, and this is a pivot, but I want to expand this conversation into what you're covering, right? You are a proud Sudanese American. You've talked about leaning into our culture now more than ever before. But then you also talk about stereotypes. You talk about the caricature of our identities being projected into the media and even political landscape. I want you to talk a little bit about what you call transference through projection, which leads to stereotypes forming. When we talk about sounds and soundscapes and chasing them, that's part of the culture, which is beautiful and it's rich and it has so much history, but all of that gets lost when we see our identities here in the U.S., right? So talk to me a little bit about that.
Sure. So I'm married to a psychiatrist. I learn a lot from him about our behaviors and our brains and how they connect certain ideas to each other. And there is this idea in psychology called transference, which is when I see something in a certain light, the next time I see that certain thing, I will imagine it in that light that I saw it before. And I will transfer that feeling that I felt to this new situation. And so for me, bringing it into this idea of stereotypical imagery and the single narrative, as author Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie kind of warned us against the danger of the single narrative, I talked about this idea of, if I am in the U.S. and I am a Black man, and if on TV and in film, the image I see of a Black man is the gangster, is violence, or is the basketball player, or is the rapper, right? Then the next time I see a Black man on the street, what's my reference? My reference is those references that I saw in media. And so I project what I saw on this new person who has nothing to do with all the things that I saw, but who happens to look the same.
I'm so glad you brought up the basketball player, because a lot of people may be like, oh, but what's wrong with that?
Right. It's still a stereotype. I have siblings and cousins and friends who are tall Sudanese Black boys who don't like to play basketball. We're a soccer people. So it's, you know, sometimes it's harmful. Sometimes it's not harmful, but it's still, it's not, it's off, right? It's still, you have a stereotype about me. And so for Black women, that might also be things like, in media, a lot of the time, Black women are portrayed as loud and sassy and, you know, talking like this with the neck, and strong as well, just like strong Black women. That image is the one that we in our brains attach to the image of a Black woman. And we go out into the world and project that on every Black woman we see. And that's dangerous. That's dangerous because it eliminates individuality.
Absolutely. Do you think people sometimes lean into positive stereotypes?
For protection, yes, I do. I do. I think we do that a lot to kind of, I think it's a defense mechanism too sometimes, where it's like, okay, if I'm going to be stereotyped, it might as well be something good. Like the model minority stereotype, right? With the Asian communities, that, you know, seemingly on the surface, it sounds like, hey, it's a great stereotype. We're smart. But then what does that lead to, right? It has been harmful in many cases.
How do people within these different communities become more aware of how they are being stereotyped? Because as I said, sometimes we tend to lean into so-called positive stereotypes. So how do we combat that?
I think as immigrants, many immigrants come to this country. I'm not going to say everybody, of course, but I think many of us come to this country with an idea of who is already in this country. And with, you know, many of us come with our degrees. Many of us come with education, and we come to this country and treat people unfairly here. I mean, for us, in terms of Black immigrants, it's been an issue where African immigrants have been, you know, many of them have been trying to like separate themselves from African Americans when they come here. We are not them. We are educated. We get jobs immediately. We are more serious. there are so many stereotypes and images and self-stereotypes that they come in with and embrace against the people that are already here, right? Which is African Americans.
But let me play devil's advocate for a minute. When they say we are not them, that is true though.
It is true in terms of we are not a monolith. Of course we're different, right? Of course we are different, but we are not better. We are different, but not better. And that's the issue. Coming here thinking you are better than somebody, where that somebody has been disenfranchised for centuries, and that somebody's ancestors, you know, were brought against their will to this country. And that somebody, if not for their civil rights struggles, you would not be able to step foot in this country.
Basically preserving yourself at the expense of somebody else's humanity.
I see it all the time. And it's something I talk about to our community all the time, where there's this desire to separate from the African-American community here because of the stereotypical imagery that we talked about in the beginning. Because back home in our countries, what movies do we get? And what shows do we get, right? Same stereotypical imagery of the African American. And so when they come here, it's stay away, live next to the white people. It's better for you. Boy, don't do your hair like that so you don't look like them. Don't talk like them. We need to separate ourselves thinking you are better than them.
You said you've had those conversations within your community. What do those conversations look like? Can you share anything?
They're difficult because you are trying to convince people about something they are not used to doing. First of all, these are people that come because most probably they're looking for opportunity, right? They're looking for jobs. They're looking for education. A lot of them are escaping trauma and war. Our country has been a troubled country. It still is. Conflict is a big thing. And so there are many refugees as well. So what I try to talk about is at least have the humility. Come here with curiosity. Come to learn about people that look like you, that are in the end your brother and sister that come from the same continent. And so that is what I try to talk about. You know, some people tune me out and don't want to hear it. And still they go along in their ways. They feel like their values that they want to hold on to are different than the values of certain communities. You know, some people are going to get it. Some people are not. But my thing is at least study the history of African Americans in this country. At least understand why things are the way they are. Maybe then you'll have some empathy and understanding.
Absolutely, Hannah. But at the same time, you've also talked about, as I said in the beginning, leaning into your culture, right? And you call it an act of resistance. People like you and I should be leaning more into our culture right now, given the political climate that we are in. How do we do this without exposing ourselves to the harm that comes with it? Being a Muslim woman from Pakistan, being an immigrant, having an accent, we are at the center of so many different intersections. So how do I lean into my culture while I protect myself?
I mean, and many of us are from countries that are named by name. I am from one. We are named by name. We have been on lists. We are on the ban lists all the time. Any ban list, you'll find Sudan. But I think leaning into our culture is also healing for us, and it's cathartic to us. And that's a need right now in this atmosphere where people are honestly just afraid of what's coming tomorrow, what new executive order will happen, and what is my destiny? What will happen to me? What will happen to my family and my children? And so when I say lean into your culture, maybe it's not an outward, just for protection's sake, I think. Maybe I don't mean an outward leaning into culture, but using your culture as a protective mechanism, gathering more with your community and your people and cooking your foods and listening to your music. It feels protective, and it feels like this very thing that this country maybe is trying to attack, it's something that I hold dear. And it's something that I want my kids to hold dear as well. So that's what I mean. I don't think I mean, you know, protection is important. I don't think I mean go out into the street and create some kind of parade or ruckus in some way, bringing attention to yourself. But I meant it as a means of healing and being a cathartic tool for us.
How are you leaning into your culture?
Whoo, let me show you. Where is it? So this is called a mubkhar. A mubkhar, we are a very perfume-loving culture and incense. And so you put some coals in here, and it's like a pot, because this is audio, I guess. It's a colorful kind of clay pot that is from Sudan, and it's where we burn our incense. So we put some coals in and get some little bits of sandalwood, maybe, or little bits of our perfumed woods, and put it on the coal. And it's clouds and clouds of just fragrance. In the Western sense, it's aromatherapy, right? But this is hundreds and hundreds of years old, right? So we're doing our bakhur, these folk tales that I'm putting into a podcast. That has been very healing and cathartic as well. Leaning into like old stories and asking my mom and my uncles and my father to talk about what their childhood was like and the music. It's all of that. But for me, I love scent and I love sound. So it's stories and it's the smells. Sudan is also a big wedding perfume culture. So when you get married, the aunties all come and create new perfumes for you that you will carry on with you. I still have mine because there's always like a starter of the perfume at the bottom. It's like a dough and it always stays. And throughout the years, you keep adding on to it oils. Anyway, it's a whole thing. So yeah, just go into my closet and take a whiff of perfume. And it's like a private leaning into culture that helps out with moments of trauma.
The cinematic event of the year. Critics say astonishing, tremendous, a triumph of savings.
Are you talking about Death of a Unicorn?
No, Sergey. It's 2-for-1 cinema tickets from Compare the Market.
Oh.
But you can use this magnificent offer to see Death of a Unicorn only in cinemas.
Woohoo!
Get 2-for-1 cinema tickets every Tuesday or Wednesday with Compare the Market. Simples!
When you take out a qualifying product to Compare the Market, one membership per year, participating cinemas, 2 standard tickets only, cheapest free. T's and C's apply.
You mentioned folk tales. Now, I grew up with them as well. They are pretty much rooted in culture, tradition, language, community, passing them on from one generation to another. But how do you keep or preserve the essence of those folk tales as you tell them in a different language? Because in my mind, there are certain words in every language that cannot be translated or transferred into another language. They are so specific to that language.
Let me tell you, it's been a journey. It has been a journey of, first of all, I struggled with this question of, do I have a right to tell these stories? Whose stories are they? Who do they belong to? Can I tell them and do justice to them in 2025 California? So I had to take time to talk to my family members and to do a lot of research about you know, the art of storytelling, oral storytelling heritage and who it belongs to. And being a journalist, you know, we're big on no plagiarism, copyright, the IP. So in the end, I landed on, you know, something my mother told me, which comes from a Muslim concept also, that in Islam, I think the Prophet said something like, I'm going to badger this, I know, but something like Islam takes the form or in the flavor. It's like a river. Islam is like a river. And wherever it goes, whatever land it lands in, it takes the flavor of that people. And then it keeps going and it takes the flavor and the color of that people. And so I love that too. And so she said, stories are like that. They are alive and they're a living heritage and breathing. And whoever tells them adds to them, right? They take the flavor of wherever they are. And even these folk tales, you go to Northern Sudan, they're different. You go to Southern Sudan, tribe from tribe, there's a difference. And that's a beautiful thing. That's what I ended up with. It's a beautiful thing. And if it's my time to carry on this tradition thousands of miles away because of this life we are living where we have to be in a diaspora, then that's the way it has to be. Then that's the way it will be preserved in this new land. And that takes me to the language issue. I knew that I'm a person who grew up in the United States in a Sudanese family. I step out into the world and it's all English and it's all America. And I craved being able to see myself in media, in the books we saw at the library, in the cartoons we watched, in the Disney movies. You know, we're just used to not seeing ourselves. And so I know that there are thousands and thousands of diaspora Sudanese children who are like I was. And they didn't have access to go to Sudan a lot. And they didn't have access to the Arabic. And they're more comfortable in English. And my thinking was, don't they too deserve to embrace and enjoy their own heritage in a language that they understand? Or is it because they don't understand the language, you throw the baby with the bathwater and say, okay, you're not going to know anything about your culture since you don't know the Arabic? I don't think that's fair. And so for me, it was a matter of, let me translate the storytelling, but keep the names of the characters, the foods that are brought up, the little songs that we have. We have little songs in each story there and the Arabic in these stories. And so it was a balance. And I always went back. My mother is my editor. I call her my editor. And so I always say, so what if I say this? What does this mean? And what if I say this? And I also have little kids who are my focus group as well. And so there are many groups that I sought advice from for this, for it to be engaging for kids who are in America in this day and age.
Not easy.
Not easy at all. Let me tell you, these kids are picky. They've seen everything and they've heard everything. And so I had to package this in a way that is attractive to them with sound design, with music. So I'm blessed that our audio engineers at the radio station I work for wanted to work with me on this. And they are like multiple award-winning, Peabody Award-winning, Emmy Award-winning sound engineers. And so we were able to create something, I think, that is true to the origin. If there's something that couldn't be translated, I left it in the Arabic and did a little explanation of what it may mean.
Anna, how does bilingual thinking sound like in your head when you switching between Arabic and English? And this is something that I'm really interested in these days. I've spoken to multiple guests about code switching and using multiple languages, especially doing a folktale, right? What parts do you think warrant an Arabic language usage versus English?
Code switching is big in any diaspora, right? And for us in the Sudanese diaspora, we even have a name for it. There's a language of the diaspora that has been developed just organically over the years, which we call it Arabizi. Arabizi is like Arabi and Ingilizi together. And so even in the writing, the letter ha in Arabic is written as a 7. And the letter ayn in Arabic is written as a 3 because it kind of looks like it, but facing the other way. And so there is a language. There is a new language of the diaspora, right? This is a language if we're talking about how languages develop.
And that's your flavor added to these folktales, right?
Absolutely. And so once upon a time, Muhammad and Fatna were a brother and sister, and they had a big hush that they lived in. Hush, hush, I leave hush in there, right? Hush is yard. But in the sense of Sudan, if I say yard in English or backyard or front yard in the American sense, you know, it's the front yard, it's the backyard with the...
There's no novelty.
There's no
curiosity or mystery around it, right?
So then I have to describe it. Like al-hush, where like the henna tree was over here and the lemon tree was nearby and the beds were all in the yard and the grandmother would sit on a bed with her tea next to her. And so the concepts are a little different than an American child would imagine. But then that's up to me to describe, right, as a storyteller, to really paint the picture and take you there, which is what I do, right? Like, that's my profession. And so I think that's why this was perfect. But yeah, I love embracing this new language of Arabizi. I mean, even at the top of in the intro of every episode, I say, Izzayakum. Izzayakum means hey, or how's it going, or what's going on. Izzayakum. Welcome to Folk Tales from Sudan. I'm your host, da 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 da. And I insert these kind of words, or at the beginning of the story, I say ga lukan fi, which means once upon a time, and the ga lu is usually stretched out by the grandmother because she's trying to get all the kids and gathering them. So she's calling out to the children to kind of, okay, it's time. It's time for story time. And so I leave that in there. So I leave in things that reflect the flavor of sitting with a grandma or an uncle or an auntie in Sudan, in a hush in Sudan, getting ready to listen to the story.
I don't know if that's intentional or not, but as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking through this process, you're actually normalizing a language into everyday vernacular that's been long seen as a threat in the West, right? Arabic itself, people don't understand it at all. Like, I grew up in Pakistan. I don't understand Arabic.
But also, it's dangerous. I know a lot of people who've stopped speaking Arabic in public. That's a thing.
Right. Because you don't know what the other person may be thinking the minute they hear Arabic. Again, those stereotypes kick in. And just to make it part of everyday living and storytelling, it is an act of resistance, right? It's resisting the reductive ideas of who speaks Arabic, what the language entails. Who is your audience through this? I know you mentioned Sudanese diaspora kids who have some connection to Sudan, but I wonder if you're also trying to target or address all the kids in the U.S. from all different cultures.
Absolutely. You know, growing up in the U.S., we heard the stories that are the European stories, right? It was Cinderella. It was Snow White. It was maybe some 1001 Arabian Nights like Aladdin and Sinbad. There were no African stories that I remember hearing, let alone Sudan, right? And so for me, this was also a project. I've always believed that our stories deserve a global audience. I would go to Sudan on vacations and sit and hearing these stories. You know, we were little cousins and we would hear the stories from my uncle and he would stand up and perform the stories, right? Acting out the characters and everything. And I would think this would make an amazing movie. And this coming from a child who has the world of Disney and the world of Saturday morning cartoons and the world of children's literature here in the US. And then I would go to Sudan and be totally mesmerized in a way that never happened to me in the US. So I've always believed that our stories deserve a bigger audience and for the world to know the stories. So this also is part of this project, is get to know Sudan with something other than what you're used to hearing about Sudan, which is the war and conflict and famine and poverty. Whatever you hear in the headlines creates that image that we talked about. So my goal is when somebody hears these folk tales, next time they hear the word Sudan, maybe part of them will remember the beauty of these folktales.
You're basically unflattening people's stories the way they've been flattened for so long into case studies and sound bites and stereotypes. You're really unflattening them.
That's the goal. That danger of the single story. Again, I believe we have so much beauty that the world just doesn't get to see. And so this is a chance for them to see one corner of it.
Anna, you mentioned when you used to go to Sudan, your uncle would act it out for you, right? Which brings me to the visual experience of these stories. Right now, it's an auditory experience that you're sharing with your audience. Do you have any plans for the visual aspect of it? Like, do you plan to work on that in the future?
For me, I have always loved the voice. And the intimacy of one person telling you something. And oral storytelling heritage for me, what drew me to it was I get to use my imagination
through
to
your
imagine
voice.
What the witch looks like. And imagine what the ghoul, the scary ghoul, ooh, he had big eyes and he had long teeth. And so it keeps your imagination working, which is something I think pediatricians today are recommending a lot with all the screen time that our children are having. The imagination is becoming lazy. So bringing back an ancient form of entertainment, because our ancestors did not have a screen. Our ancestors had to act it all out, right? And I want to bring that back. I want to bring back, listen, and I will try my best to explain and to describe how the witch looked and how Muhammad and his sister Fatma are sitting there. And I'll do my best, but you get to use your imagination also and rest your eyes as well. So, I mean, the answer is no, not for now. You know, people are asking me about this. Is it going to be video? Are you going to make cartoons? For the time being, it's a no. But who knows? Never say never, right?
You mentioned your mom is your editor, right? Which is fascinating to me. A lot of pressure on your mom. And I can see that happening because every time my girls have questions about Pakistani culture, they'll call me or they'll ask me questions. And sometimes it's like, I feel burdened because I'm like, look, it's it's the culture that I lived in. I internalized it without even knowing, right? I was present in it. I wasn't as aware or intentional about the culture that I was breathing. But I wonder if there's been a time when you've told a story for public radio that your mom or your family member were like, ah, not happening, did not like it, did not agree with it. Because you are a journalist and you grew up in the U.S., so your lens in some ways must be a bit different from your immigrant parents, right?
Yeah, there's some things that are like, ooh, you know, these are our secrets, or this is, aib is an Arabic word, which means shame.
Flaw. I thought flaw. It was flaw.
Flaw, but it's also used as like, aib, that's aib, which means like, don't do it, it's shameful or whatever. And so as a second generation, I have less of those feelings. And so I did a story once. I'm obsessed with culture. I love cultural storytelling. And that's always been my thing throughout journalism. Not the headline story or the breaking news story. That's never my thing. It is the people, how they live, what they believe, what they eat and drink. And just that's my jam, as they say. And understandably, a lot of my storytelling was about Sudan. And I talked earlier about my love of our love as a culture of perfume and incense. So I did an episode, I did a story about this ritual that we have that a bride does when she's getting ready to get married, which is called Dukhan. Dukhan translates to smoke bath, which a bride for 40 days before the wedding, every day, she sits unclothed on a hole in the ground that has burning sandalwood. So the smoke of the sandalwood infuses her body. And, you know, it's for the wedding and it's for the man and it's for... And so when I told my mom, and my mom is naturally, she's a shy person anyway. She was like, oh, be careful. What are you going to say? You're going to say she was naked under the blanket. And then, you know, and of course, you know, she's naked under the blanket. And but it's a beauty ritual. There is a little resistance there because, again, that leads to another issue of this is for the man and the wedding night. And, you know. She was just like, why do you have to do this one?
You know, the funny thing is, as you're narrating this story, I'm thinking a lot of times, all of us from diaspora, and I'm talking about first-gen immigrants like me or your mom, we unintentionally, or maybe in our subconscious, sometimes we try to present stories from our culture that are too polished, too clean, too nice. It's almost as if we are stripping our stories of the messiness or the interesting, the lesser talked about quirks because we feel like our stories will be judged. And maybe for second gen like you, you were less encumbered by these thoughts.
Absolutely. That was the case. That's why with every story, I had to be careful, you know, just like, what would my mom say? Or like, everybody's going to hear this. How does this reflect on my family? Right? Like the things that we think about that maybe the average reporter in the station doesn't think about. Doesn't care at all. But for us, there's just like image, right? The image. And that's something that I've had to fight a lot. I haven't really done really controversial stories because of that. And I'm not prone to like liking controversy anyway. But yeah, that's always at the back of our minds. The mommy's always at the back, just like that. What will mama think? And I'm trying to instill that into my daughters as they're in the Instagram world now and posting pictures of themselves and be like, mama's watching, mama's...
I know. I've probably done that to my kids.
Girl, I have to be like, that shirt, pull up.
Yeah, it's a battle. It's a struggle. Let me put it that way. Anna, in the end, if you were to define the United States of America, how would you do that?
How would I describe the United States? And what a time to be asking this question. I don't know if your previous guests answered in this time, in this day and age that we are living, where it is very, very difficult for many of us with immigrant backgrounds, many of us who have feet in two worlds where there is fear, where there is uncertainty right now. But I am, for better or worse, an optimist and a believer that people are good until they prove otherwise. And so I have always, you know, growing up in America, and raising my daughters in America, we have always talked about this being a beautiful place where you get to see so many different people from so many different cultures and backgrounds, and get to know the world through, especially where we live, it's very diverse. The coasts, if you live on the coast, you're going to get a lot of diversity.
I can only be a coastal immigrant, to be honest.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, before California, I lived in the Washington, D.C. area. DMV, shout out to the DMV. My family's still there. But I mean, America, and also we come from countries where there is a lot of oppression. And there are rules, societal rules, governmental rules, dictatorships that... You come here and you are appreciative of the freedom that you have here. But it's a difficult time to embrace joy right now as an immigrant and a child of immigrants. But I still believe in this country. I still believe the people of this country are good. And we make the people of this country.
That's us.
That's us. That's us and that's our kids.
Thank you so much, Anna. This was so good. And where can people find these folk tales?
All right. So we are on Spotify and on Apple Podcasts. It's just Folk Tales from Sudan. We kept it simple. And we're also on YouTube because we have some amazing art. So again, we're not video, we're not animation, but my talented cousin created some lovely story art. With every story, there is an image that you can see so you can relate to what the story is telling. But that's where you can find us. Folk Tales from Sudan on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts.
Again, despite my voice or lack thereof, we were able to do this incredible interview. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sadia. I really appreciate being on. Thanks for the lovely conversation.
You know, as Anna was telling these folk tales, I was literally visualizing them, watching them in my mind. The reel was on. I kid you not, the reel was on. What a great conversationalist. And by the way, in the end, I asked Anna to send us some Sudanese music created by Sudanese musicians. We'll put it in the audio. You must have already listened to it in this episode. We will credit it in our show notes. I am so glad I had this conversation with Anna, despite my voice. And thank you for bearing with me, for coming back every week, for listening, for sharing, for writing reviews. And if you haven't, please do. It's important. This is how Immigrantly becomes more visible. And these conversations, authentic, honest, raw conversations, become more accessible to others. This episode was produced and written by me, Zaria Khan. The editorial review is done by Sheng Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Lou Raskin. Immigrantly's theme music is by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Academic Sound. Come back next week when I have another incredible story for all of you. Take care and be kind to yourself.